Welcome to Parents' Perspective. Oh, Carl threw up his hands in distress. He's at it again. He looked at his brother-in-law in dismay. Kev, you've got kids. Aren't they supposed to sleep sometime? Kevin looked up from his coffee. Yeah, they usually do, although sometimes not all night. Well, this is daytime, Carl shot back, and I just fed her. Aren't they supposed to nod off to sleep after they eat? Yeah, I think so at some point. Mine sure did. They'd chow down and then get so droopy I'd have to wake them just to change their diapers, Kevin replied. But Carrie cries after every meal, it seems, Carl complained. It's all I can do to settle her down for a nap. She's just so fussy. Well, Benji did go through a fussy period when he was little, Kevin remembered. I think it was from a milk allergy or something. What does your doctor say? That's an idea, Carl replied.
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about food allergies in children? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has been enriching his earlier, more traditional medical practice for many years in order to more effectively work with children whose well-being is dramatically affected by their diets. Dr. Richard Layton is a board-certified pediatrician who practiced primary care pediatrics for 15 years. For more than 20 years, he has been evaluating and treating children with allergies, recurrent infections, behavioral and/or developmental problems. Often underlying allergies or hypersensitivities play a significant role in other medical areas. The allergy practice incorporates conventional and complementary medicine, prioritizing the medical history, listening to the patient and/or the parents, clinical judgment, and common sense. Dr. Layton is the parent of two grown children and grandfather of eight. Welcome to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Layton.
Thank you for inviting me.
What would you say is the biggest myth about kids' food allergies?
The prevailing thought amongst the medical community is not only about fixed food allergies, but that allergies are limited to runny nose, stuffy nose, itchy eyes, asthma, and eczema. I have found that allergies are far beyond the fixed food reaction, and I would include, for want of a better term, hypersensitivities. And I have found that it's not only the typical nose, eyes, skin, and lungs, but head to toe, gastrointestinal complaints, children who have bloating, difficulty with regular bowel movements, muscle and joint pain, headaches, fatigue, attention span. So that would be the number one myth. And it gets back to the way we're trained in medical school in the science of medicine. Medical school tends to attract individuals interested in science, research, and that's the way it's taught. We learn about diseases very well. Consequently, problems where there's a lab test, a protocol, a double-blind study, a treatment that's well accepted, the care is better. So if it's a problem that can be as severe as diabetes, cancer, there's an answer, there's an approach, and doctors are better at that. The problem with allergies, especially food allergies, is how it's interpreted amongst a majority of physicians. It's thought to be very overrated. If a child or an adult develops hives all over, difficulty breathing, asthma, even cardiorespiratory arrest, that's well accepted as being a fixed food allergy. It's all in the history. If you take enough time to get a history, listen to the parent, observe the child, you usually get your answer. Sir William Osler, who is my personal medical hero, well revered in medical history, was at Johns Hopkins for many years, a brilliant internist who said a number of great things, and one of them was, medicine is a science of uncertainty and an art of probability.
How can we tell if our child has a food allergy as opposed to, say, a tummy ache or indigestion or contact dermatitis or something else?
Well, it is in the history, and one good example would be food cravings, that a child who craves a certain food may have a problem with that food. And that actually was what compelled me to leave practicing primary care pediatrics as far back as 1985 after 15 years. It was two children who changed my career. And the first was a boy with horrible migraines who I referred to an excellent pediatric neurologist who did all the testing and said, I think it's psychosomatic. At the time, I said to the mother, I've been doing some reading. Is there a food that your son eats every day all the time? She says, well, he loves peanut butter. I said, do this. Take him off the peanut butter for 2 weeks and then give me a call. End of headaches.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow.
So that kind of woke me up. What's going on here? I didn't learn this one in medical school. The second child had horrible abdominal pain. I had already run basically the tests you needed to do to rule out a medical problem. And at the time, you can't do this now. We actually admitted her in the hospital and had all the specialists come around. You can't do this today with managed care. And everyone came to the same conclusion that this was psychosomatic. And at that point, I said, she does drink a lot of milk. Why don't you take her off milk? End of abdominal pain. So those two kids made me question much of what I was doing on a daily basis. I started taking courses, reading, and the more I read, the more I didn't like that aspect of the way I was practicing. So to answer your question, food cravings, reading, being a detective, that's the job the parents should be doing to try and figure these things out.
It's really hard for me to understand how a craving could be connected to the actual allergy. In other words, a child who really loves peanut butter is eating the worst thing that child could be eating.
Aren't we always sort of told that when we crave something, it's because our body needs whatever it is that's in that? That's what seems so diametrically opposite for a child to crave something that does damage.
But that's the reality of it. An 11-year-old boy who had what he called seizure headaches, who was a behavioral disaster. He actually had been admitted into an inpatient psychiatric hospital for 1 month. Now, 11-year-olds, you'd have trouble saying, I want you to stop this food. He was drinking a gallon of milk a day. And I said, you know, I think I can help you, but I'm going to make a deal. Cut your milk by 50%. When he came back about 6 weeks later, not only had he cut the milk 50%, he cut it out. And his headaches and his behavior were dramatically improved. And when you talk about what foods are the most likely, milk is number one, cow's milk. Wheat, corn, soy, chemical preservatives. A lot of kids love candy. Most can handle it. But this red dye, yellow dye, additives, preservatives, nitrates, MSG, parents need to read labels when they go to the supermarket and when they see natural flavorings. Who knows what natural flavorings are? That may be MSG. So, again, we have to become detectives and look at if our child's doing fine eating these foods, doesn't have a weight problem, doing well socially, fine. But if the child is having difficulty, whether it's an obvious allergic problem or not feeling well, not sleeping well, having difficulties behaviorally, absolutely developmentally, parents need to be detectives and start reading the labels.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on children's food allergies.
Popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Richard Layton about children's food allergies.
Are there certain kinds of kids who might be more prone to food allergies, kids who we should be watching from the very beginning to see if they develop allergic reactions? And I guess this also ties into whether others in the family have allergies.
Exactly. I think genetics would be number one, that if you have a parent, or worse, parents who have specific issues, that child is more at risk to have a similar issue. It's well known that children who really do have ADHD, there's a higher rate of at least one parent also having attention issues, hyperactivity issues, at least when they were children. The same holds true of allergies. If you have an adult who grew up with allergies, you have a better chance that their offspring will also. So that would be the number one, would be genetics. Looking at a child, look at the eyes. There's circles under the eyes. They're known as allergic shiners. And this is something the parents have trouble doing, but a physician could look inside the nose, and there's an anatomic area called the turbinate inside the nose that when that's swollen and pale, it's a giveaway that your child has allergies. It's easy when it's with pollen allergies, with itchy eyes, and difficulty breathing, stuffy nose. But sometimes, just like yesterday, we may want to discuss later, I saw twins, one with a seizure disorder who responded to a diet, and the other with asthma who responded to dietary restriction. So it can be easy and it can be complicated.
Well, I bet it wasn't easy to figure those out.
The mother figured it out. My job was easy, yeah.
Well,
suppose you have a genetic predisposition to a certain allergy, or you think that the child might. Can it present differently? In other words, can the parent have seizures and the kid have a rash on his ankle or something?
Absolutely. And very often you pick an area like a mold, which is tricky. So you may have a parent who knows that he or she has a mold allergy, and it might affect them as being irritable, tired, depressed, where the kid may be flying around the room.
That's interesting. So depression can be an allergic symptom?
I think so. That doesn't mean that everybody who's depressed has allergies, but you need to look at, besides just automatically diagnosing depression, again, if you take enough time to get the history, you may find that there are underlying reasons for the depression.
Well, how early in life can a food allergy show up?
I'd say day one.
Swell.
Yeah, I'd say day
one. Get the
one.
Peanut butter out of the nursery.
Yeah, well, if you see children who have difficulty with formula or breastfeeding, the first thing I'll look at with a breastfeeding mother is, what are you eating? And if they're drinking milk, and this comes up in what I call my family practice. I have a private practice and a family practice. My family practice is my family. So this is a...
no remuneration for that one, right?
This is a cousin's daughter who is having difficulty. And I said, are you drinking milk? And she said, yes. I said, stop and see what happens. And the child's already 50% better.
Can a child become allergic to something he wasn't previously affected by? And can a child outgrow a food allergy?
A good question at any time. I personally developed asthma at age 22. And I have to say that's the reason I became interested in allergies as a medical student. So it can happen at any time, certainly in childhood. The prevailing thought is that a third to a half of children outgrow their allergies. What I see in the adults I take care of is they may outgrow what was their childhood allergy, but then it comes back in another form. Children can react to a medication differently than adults. So a decongestant may hop up an adult and make a child very solemn. An antihistamine can make an adult sleep for 4 to 24 hours. A child may be up all night. Mm. It's the same with allergies. It may present in a different way. When I do the allergy testing, typically if someone reacts, the child is flying by my room and the adult is killed over with a headache and exhausted.
So how does a parent know when we're thinking of giving an antihistamine or a decongestant or something like that, whether that's going to make the child walk on the ceiling all night or not?
Sometimes it's trial and error. I say, you know, give this around 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock so you kind of have a lead where you may get a couple hours of sleep the first time you try one of these things.
What should we do if we suspect that our youngster has a food allergy? Can we just eliminate that food from his diet, or do we have other things we need to do?
Well, I personally believe that an elimination diet is a great way to be a detective. It's not easy, but it's something you can do at home. If more pediatricians asked their parents to try an elimination diet, it would make practicing pediatrics much more interesting than giving rote answers. So there's two ways to do this. One, the easier way is the single elimination diet, where you take the crave food, take it out of the diet for 7 to 10 days, then do what's called a food challenge. And if it's a child going to school, I heartily suggest Saturday morning around 7, 8 o'clock. So if it's a nightmare reaction, there's 2 days to recover so your child doesn't miss any school. So let's say it's milk or wheat. You take that out of the diet for 7 to 10 days, then give it back as a glass of milk or a couple pieces of bread. And when it's out of the diet, you remove what's known as the masking. So if someone's taking a food every day and it might be causing the headache or the hyperactivity, it's impossible to know that food causes that problem. But if you take it out of the diet and then give it back as a food challenge, chances are you will know it on that Saturday morning. So that's a single elimination diet. I'd say the big foods, I've already mentioned milk and wheat, soy, egg, and corn, big peanut, obviously, chocolate, citrus, preservatives, and additives. So a parent who is strong and powerful enough to say, I'm going to take my kid off all these foods, do that for 10 days, then give one back every 2 to 3 days, and you'll have more answers. So a lot depends on the parent, the child, what each is willing to do, how significant the problem is. That's the best way to find out.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on children's food allergies.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Richard Layton about children's food allergies.
Well, I have a problem just thinking about how one would do this with all these different allergens. This is higher math for me, but suppose there are permutations and combinations where it's red dye number 2 and milk or something. Are there interactions that are possible or combinations?
Well, again, the history. The child with a red dye problem is more likely to have what are known as sensory issues. So it's a child whose central nervous system, I call it hyper alert. It may be sensitive to sound, notice smells, be bothered by tags on his shirt, won't wear tight clothing, doesn't like the way the seam of a sock is, may have difficulty with space, not knowing where he or she begins and somebody else begins and ends. So that type of child may do well on what's known as the Feingold diet. And the Feingold diet, which was discovered by Dr. Ben Feingold in 1975, and not well thought of in pediatric circles, but the reality is it has two parts to it. And both are difficult, but the easier part is eliminating all the dyes, additives, and preservatives. And personally, I don't think anybody should be eating chemicals, not just hyperactive kids. But there are books written by the Feingold Society that parents could purchase. And I would start with that stage two of eliminating the chemicals. And that would be one approach. Stage one is tougher. That includes foods that contain salicylate. So it's just about every fruit, tomato, much more difficult. I happen to see parents who are amazing. When they come to see me, I would say 90% of them are willing to do what they have to do to get the job done. For the parents who would find that the elimination diet is just not going to happen, or they've done the elimination diet and they found that it didn't work, that's where allergy testing and treatment may be something good to really look at. This is very controversial. One of the other things that led me into joining an allergy practice was I wasn't real pleased with the allergy results I was getting referring to the allergist. Good with hay fever, good with treating hives, but if you didn't have hay fever, there wasn't much going on. I have found since that the method of allergy testing, scratch testing, is much better for cat, dog, grass, tree, weed, dust, and it's not good at all for molds and foods. So very often I see kids who've been to an allergist and they've been told your child doesn't have mold or food allergies. The technique I use is called provocation neutralization.
Provocation sounds good with kids.
Yeah, but basically it's giving a stronger dilution of the allergen intradermal under the skin and evoking a positive reaction and then finding the dilution that's weaker where the reaction doesn't occur. And then treatment can be made up based on the testing. That's called sublingual immunotherapy. Okay. Sublingual means under the tongue. So it's taking the serum under the tongue, which is much safer than being injected.
Okay.
And that's a good way to treat mold and food allergies. Sublingual immunotherapy is very popular in Europe. It's just starting to be studied in the United States. But we're about 20, 30 years behind. So I don't know in my lifetime that we're going to catch up to what's going on in Europe. But it's a wonderful way to treat allergies. It's a compromise where you don't have to be as restrictive. And it's a way to treat dust, pollen, pet, mold, and food allergies. A history that I find pretty amazing. This was a child who appeared to be autistic at 24 months. And the history was, I have some terrific results, and so do a number of other doctors, who put children with autism on a casein-free, gluten-free diet. Casein is a milk protein, so it's basically milk, yogurt, ice cream, cheese. Gluten is more difficult. Wheat, oat, barley, rye, spelt. This was a 24-month-old child who had a speech evaluation, and it was documented that the language was at a 9-month level. The parents put this child on a casein-free, gluten-free diet for 2 months, and at age 26 months was speaking at a 26-month age level.
Wow.
It's a wonderful example of something even worse than the behavior of a child who's speech delayed, mm-hmm. thought to be autistic at 2 years of age, and literally turns it around in 2 months.
Wow.
That's a miracle. I think the best book to read is Doris Rapp's Is This Your Child? So it's all in there about elimination diet. So if there's one book to read, that would be it.
Dr. Layton, what's the most important thing for parents to know about children's food allergies? We're talking about a lot of different aspects. What would you say is the A number one important thing we need to get across?
A real hands-on approach. Be a parent first and not be the child's best friend.
Well, unfortunately, we have to close in a minute, but before we do, are there resources that you would suggest for our listeners who want to pursue further some of these issues?
Again, the Doris Rapp book, Is This Your Child? There's another book that's very good called Childhood Illness and the Allergy Connection, written by Zoltan Rona. I'll spell that. Zoltenrona. My website is www.allergyconnection.com.
Well, this has been an incredible connection. You have been wonderful in giving us so much to think about and so much to remember when we're trying to deal with children's food allergies. So, Dr. Richard Layton, thank you so much for being with us.
And thank you for having me.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Raising a Successful Child: Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 339 and tell us, if you can, what station you are listening to.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.